everyone. Welcome. I'm Carrie L., and this is Carrie L.'s Heartlink Show. And as I connect to as many hearts as possible, we are creating more freedom, light, and love, one interview at a time. My programs will bring you insights into the Great Awakening that is underway on planet Earth as we approach 2012. I'll be keeping you abreast of the latest tools available now for anchoring a greater and healthier reality into your life. I'll be interviewing cutting-edge experts in the metaphysical, scientific, paranormal, and spiritual realms. Stay tuned for the next hour as I speak with a special international authority on archaeology and the anomalies of archaeology, and the principal author of Forbidden Archaeology, and the author of Human Devolution, that is Michael Cremo. I'm really excited about this show, so stay tuned, and we will have callers at the bottom of the hour. Should you want to call in, there are 800 numbers on the internet there, so you can see those and call in. But for now, just take a deep breath and relax. And the blessing for the day comes from the Gayatri Prayer. Let us focus on that effulgent light from which the whole universe is projected. May this inner sun enlighten our minds and hearts, and may we awaken as that light. All right, so we're going to have terrific information today, and I'm looking forward to it. I'm Carrie L., and I have a very special website I'd love for you to check on. That is at www.heartlinkinstitute.com. I have information about all sorts of things, workshops and classes that I conduct, as well as the different products that I have created. One of those is the Crop Circle Cards, which is an oracle deck using the designs from the crop circles. And so if you are interested, you can purchase those on my website at heartlinkinstitute.com. And I just want to also inform you of a workshop coming up July 23rd, which is about blueprinting your life. And I know that many feel pressure right now. All sorts of things are going on, creating within us a bit of discomfort. So this workshop may be just the thing that you're looking for. So check on that on my website. And for now, I'm going to introduce our guest. And he is on the cutting edge of science and cultural issues. He is a member of the History of Science Society, of the World Archaeological Congress, the Philosophy of Science Association, as well as the European Association of Archaeologists. After receiving a scholarship to study international affairs at George Washington University, Michael began to study the ancient histories of India, known as the Vedas. As he crossed disciplinary and cultural boundaries, he presents to his various audiences around the world a compelling case for negotiating a new consensus on the nature of reality. So without further ado, welcome Michael Cremo.
I'm really happy to be with you, Carrie, and with all your listeners.
Wonderful. You know, I've been looking forward to this, and I know that you've written now, I think it's three books. You want to tell us what they are?
Well, the first book that came out in this series was Forbidden Archaeology, and in that book, I look at evidence that shows human beings have been present on Earth for far longer periods than most scientists now believe possible. The reason I started doing that research was because of my studies in the ancient Sanskrit writings of India. You know, when I was a bit younger, I wanted to go on a journey of self-discovery, and that journey led me to many countries, studying many philosophies, and the one that made most sense to me was the Vedic philosophy of ancient India. And I began studying under one of the gurus from India, and I began studying the ancient Sanskrit writings, among which are a group called the Puranas, or the histories. And that's where I learned about this very ancient presence of humanity on Earth. So I thought, if it's really true, there should be some physical evidence for it. Of course, you know, this idea that humans have been present since the very beginning of life on Earth is something that we find in most of the ancient wisdom traditions, not just the one from India, but if we look at the Egyptian teachings, the Chinese teachings, if we look at all of them, they all pretty much say the same thing. So I thought, if there's some truth to what these ancient wisdom traditions tell us about the history of our species on this planet, there should be some evidence for it. And when I looked in the current textbooks of archaeology and anthropology, I didn't find any such evidence, but I decided to look deeper. I went into the original scientific reports of archaeologists from all parts of the world in many different languages. When I did that, I found something very amazing. I found that scientists, archaeologists, had actually discovered many human bones, human artifacts, and human footprints that go back many, many millions of years, as the ancient wisdom traditions tell us. And then that original book, Forbidden Archaeology, was about 900 pages long. So I brought out the book in a shorter edition called The Hidden History of the Human Race, which is about 300 pages long.
And I'm grateful for that,
yes,
by the way.
Because yeah,
I really appreciate the condensation there.
Because some people, the 900 pages is a little bit too much for them. So I decided, okay, I'll respond to that by bringing out a shorter edition of the book. But so it's one thing that really amazed me is that the longer book outsells the shorter book, But it's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And then after people read those books, I began getting some questions. One question was, what's the reaction of scientists to what you say?
Mm-hmm.
And so there was a tremendous reaction from the scientific community. Some of it was negative, some of it was positive, some of it was neutral. So I put all the responses together in a book called Forbidden Archaeology's Impact for people who were interested in that. And then I began getting more letters and calls from readers who were asking, okay, if you say that human beings have been here for many, many millions of years, and that they didn't evolve from primitive ape-like creatures, which is the current idea, then where do you think human beings came from? So to answer that question, I wrote my latest book, Human Devolution, a Vedic Alternative to Darwin's Theory. And to put it very, very simply, what I propose in that book is that we did not evolve up from matter, as most scientists now believe. Rather, we began as beings of pure consciousness and devolved from that position. In other words, the pure conscious self became covered by matter. And the purpose of human life is to re-evolve, you could say, spiritually, restore consciousness to its original pure state.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the books, Forbidden Archaeology, Hidden History of the Human Race, Forbidden Archaeology's Impact, and most recently, Human Devolution.
Wonderful. And I really appreciate that. I've studied yoga philosophy for years, and according to the yoga cycles, we are in the darkest age called the Kali Yuga right now. We're just about exiting that.
Yeah.
And going into the Satya Yuga, which is the golden age. So, and so it, there is hope, and there is good news, in other words. But you also go into detail about what it is to be a human being, which I think helps to put things into perspective.
Yes. The first thing I say in this book, Human Devolution, is that before we even ask the question, where did human beings come from, we should first of all ask the question, what is a human being?
Mm-hmm.
We should understand what we really are. Now, today, many scientists will say that a human being or any other living thing is just a combination of chemicals. They call us robot chemical machines. And I think there's much more to it than that. I don't think we're just robot chemical machines. If we look at all the evidence that comes to us from various fields of science, we will see that it's more reasonable to say that a human being is a combination of three things. Yes, ordinary matter, that's part of what a human being is. But beyond that, there is a subtle mind element with some very unusual powers like telepathy and psychokinesis. And there's all kinds of scientific evidence for this, although it's not very well known. And then beyond that subtle mind with its very unusual powers is a conscious self that can exist completely apart from matter and even mind. And this is demonstrated by evidence such as medical studies of out-of-body experiences, psychiatric accounts of past life memories, and things of that sort.
And then the last one is pure consciousness, is that right?
Yes, that is our real identity. Now, today, many scientists will say that what's really real is chemicals, matter. And if you combine the chemicals in a very complex way, then we get this thing called consciousness and all our feelings of love and all of that. But they would also say that if you disorganize the chemicals, then consciousness, love, all these feelings, there's no more basis for that. It all just evaporates away. So that really, you just have the disorganized chemicals, and that's all there is to it. But according to what I'm saying, and also what the great wisdom traditions of the world have always said, is that originally we are beings of pure consciousness. And we exist on a level of reality living in harmony with the source of all conscious beings and with all other conscious beings. And the ruling principle of that level is love, which means respect for the other. Now, if a conscious self becomes selfish and tries to put itself number one above the source of all conscious beings and above all other conscious beings, then when this mentality of selfishness develops, then that kind of conscious self can no longer exist in the harmony of that level of pure consciousness, and therefore it drifts down into lower levels of the cosmos where it becomes covered by mind and matter. And if it simply becomes covered by mind, it exists on a level where there are beings that we call gods, goddesses, astral beings, angels. People have different names for them. And then if it's too selfish to exist on that level, it goes down to an even lower level, which is the level where we find ourselves now. And then such a conscious self receives a covering not only of mind, but of ordinary matter. And this is, it's kind of easy to understand. Say, as human beings, we're normally meant to exist on the land, but if we want to exist in a foreign element like water, then we need a vehicle that will allow us to function in that alien element of water. We need a submarine or a diving suit or something that will allow us to function out of our normal element. So when a conscious self leaves its normal element of that level of pure consciousness and comes down to the level of matter, it needs a vehicle in which it can function. And those vehicles are what we call bodies. There are human bodies, plant bodies, animal bodies. According to the level of consciousness, the conscious self gets a certain kind of vehicle. Now, because the conscious selves on this level are selfish, they're in conflict with each other, we find that there's a lot of conflict. But some conscious selves, they want to return to their original position. So they don't want to engage in all of this conflict that's so characteristic of this level of reality. They want to restore that harmony where they can see each living thing, each human being, as a conscious self. We're all coming from the same source. We're all related to each other. So we see in the world there are two kinds of people, those that are becoming more and more absorbed in selfishness and conflict among individuals, conflict among nations, conflict even among religions. And then we see there are those who are trying to see the oneness of everything, that we're all spiritual beings of pure consciousness. We're all coming from the same source. We're all related. We're all from the same family, and who try to spread that knowledge in the world.
Wonderful. That just makes so much sense to me. And so we are these spiritual beings having human experiences. And it's how to get back and how to reverse the process that I'm interested in, and I know most of my listeners are.
Yes.
And I know you are.
Yes,
and
of course.
So we are these multi-dimensional beings.
Yes.
And it's interesting, though, we have been, in terms of our education system, none of that is mentioned. And so many young people today, when I see the education, I was a school psychologist for quite a while and witnessed just such a system that is not about to share this information yet. I think it's changing. I'm hoping it's changing. Because there are just so many kids now that are so unhappy and they're so bored stiff in school, and they know something is missing. So let's just put a prayer out there that we know that will shift at some point soon.
Yes, I think gradually it is shifting. I think you're right. You know, like, say if you starve yourself, then of course you're going to feel the pain of hunger. So if we don't pay attention to the needs of the spiritual self, then, of course, we're going to feel bored, we're going to feel frustrated, we're going to search for other kinds of experiences that are often not very helpful for the development of an individual or a society or a nation or a whole worldwide human civilization. I think that's the basic problem that's facing the world today, is that we've really forgotten who we are.
Mm-hmm.
And on the basis of our false identification with the material self, we get involved in all kinds of things that really aren't satisfying, that really don't help us. So I think the solution is to take advantage of the techniques for consciousness transformation that are there in the world's great wisdom traditions. And here I'm talking about something that's a little bit different from what most people would call religion. Just like a geologist could tell us how to extract the element pure gold from its ore, where it's mixed with other less valuable elements. Now, once you've extracted the gold, you could form it into coins, and then you could stamp the coins with the symbols of different nations, you know, like a U.S. gold dollar, South African, rand, and but if it's really gold, I don't think it matters what symbol that you stamp on it.
Mm-hmm.
If it's really gold, it will be valuable everywhere. So,
well, and the whole idea I think we're heading for is the idea of oneness in religions, that they all stem from that same, what you just described.
Yeah, that same original source.
And when we
yes.
get to that point, you know, we're I think it's coming up to the surface now that all the conflicts in religions for us to say no more and to stop it, to put a stop to that.
Yes, absolutely. You're absolutely right, Carrie-Ell.
And so we have seen golden ages come and go. I mean, that is my sense about the whole thing. And you describe it so well in your book. And can you give us some scientific proof that we have had golden ages?
Well, I think there are different kinds of proofs. I think one kind of proof is the records left, by these ancient civilizations, which tell of a cyclical procession of ages. For example, the ancient Sanskrit writings tell us that there's a cycle of four ages, the Satya Yuga, or the Golden Age, when life is very simple and natural, when people live for healthy lives, free of disease, free of conflict, for they live very long lives. Everyone is spiritually inclined. Everyone is engaged in the practice of yoga, which means connecting with the higher truth, through different disciplines. It's a really amazing picture of reality. And then in the next cycle, which in the Sanskrit tradition is called the Treta Yuga, people begin to get a little bit materialistic. They begin organizing themselves into class structures. They begin to build cities. They begin to engage in politics and things like that. And their lives become a little bit shorter. And they begin to experience different kinds of diseases and things like that. And then in the next age, the Dwapara Yuga, things get a little bit worse. And then finally, as you mentioned, we're now in the Kali Yuga, which is the last age of the cycle, after which the cycle begins again.
And we have materialism now in spades. I mean, it's just really in our face.
Yes.
For us to say no more. I mean, it's
right.
Way overboard.
And I think another thing, another historical fact, is that as time goes on in these cycles, communications with higher beings, higher levels of reality, begin to be lessened. And I think if we look back, say, 5,000 years, 3,000 or 4,000 years, and we look at the Egyptians, the Chinese, the Greeks, the Romans, we see that they all mention that they were in contact with higher beings, that they called gods and goddesses. It was a pretty regular thing.
Mm-hmm.
But as time goes on, those communications with beings from the higher levels gets cut off, and the types of beings that people report communicating with, sometimes they seem less than angelic sometimes. If you look at some of the reports of today of the kinds of beings that people who are called contactees or abductees report, it's not always very pleasant. But I believe that ultimately the forces of good in the universe are there. The higher beings on the ultimate level are good, and that eventually that's going to triumph.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned thing that stands out, I'm going to ask you, what was the most important discovery you found in your archaeological findings? Or give us maybe the five top ones.
Yes. Well, one, of course, to me the most interesting thing was that this information was there, because it's not mentioned in the textbooks.
Yeah.
These discoveries that humans were existing many, many millions of years ago. But some of the more interesting discoveries that I found. See, some of these discoveries were made by scientists, but some were made by ordinary people even. Like there was a case that was reported in Scientific American from the year 1852, where a beautiful metallic vase was found 15 feet deep in solid rock in Dorchester, which is near Boston, Massachusetts. And this, according to modern geologists, the age of the layer of rock in which this object was found is about 600 million years old. So that's really amazing, when you think about it. And then there was a case This is that's a case that was reported in a scientific journal, Scientific American. But then sometimes even ordinary people find these things. Like in the year 1892, there was a newspaper article published in the town of Morrisonville, Illinois. The newspaper was called the Morrisonville Times. It told how the wife of the editor of the paper, a Mrs. Robert Culp, was putting a piece of coal into her coal-burning stove. And it was a very big piece of coal, so she decided to break it in half. So she broke it in half, and inside she found a gold chain 10 inches long. And it was obvious that it had just been solidly embedded in that piece of coal. So from the report, I was able to determine what mine that this coal came from, and it turned out that the coal from this particular mine was over 300 million years old. So it appears that we had a gold chain 300 million years old. And then there were some very interesting discoveries that were made in South Africa, where miners were finding these round objects made of hematite. Now, hematite is a semi-precious stone. You can buy hematite jewelry in jewelry stores.
It's good for grounding.
Yeah. And the most amazing feature of these round metallic objects made of hematite were parallel grooves that went around the center of each object. Some of them had three of these grooves going all the way around the equator. Some had two. Some had just one. And
how large were they?
1 or 2 inches in diameter. Most of them are about 1 inch in diameter. Some of them are bigger, maybe up to 2 inches in diameter. And what was really interesting is that they're found solidly embedded in layers of rock over 2 billion years old. Now, there's a photograph of one of these objects that was published in my book, Forbidden Archaeology, and a television producer in Europe saw it. He got the book, he read it, and he decided, well, I would like to go down to South Africa and photograph that object, make a video of it, to show on television, a television program. So we got back in touch with the director of the museum who had sent us the photograph. This was Rolf Marx from the Klerksdorp Museum of Natural History in South Africa. And he told us that particular object had been stolen from the museum by a person he characterized as a white witch, which I guess means white magic instead of black magic. Mm. So, anyways, I hope somebody's putting it to good use. But
well, is that the little ball that was turning on its own with behind a glass case?
Yes, there was a report like that. There definitely was. That was one of the unusual features of this particular object. And some people are very skeptical about these things, but these objects were shown on a television special that I was a consultant for NBC. It was called The Mysterious Origins of Man. It was produced by a man named Bill Cote. And before NBC would agree to show these objects in the program, they said they had to be given to an independent company of metallurgists to examine. And when these metallurgists, scientists who study, who study metals and rocks and things like that, examined these objects, they said, we cannot explain how these things could have formed naturally in the earth. And that means they had to have been made with someone, by someone with human-like intelligence 2 billion years ago. So that's really pretty amazing. Now, if somebody could demonstrate to me exactly how these things could have formed naturally in the earth without the involvement of any conscious, intelligent being, of course I'd accept it, but up to the present moment, nobody's really been able to do that.
Well, it's interesting that we've just had a recent film come out, the latest Indiana Jones film. I don't know
if you... Crystal Skull.
The Crystal Skull. Isn't that interesting?
Oh, yes. I think people are fascinated by archaeology, and I think they all know we're not being told everything that's there. And that's really true. Another case that made it into this NBC television special, The Mysterious Origins of Man, from my book, Forbidden Archaeology, was the case of the California gold mine discoveries. We're back at the gold rush days. Miners came to California to get gold, and they were digging tunnels into the sides of mountains to get the gold. And inside the tunnels, they were finding human skeletons, all kinds of human artifacts. And these things were reported to the scientific world by Dr. J.D. Whitney, who was the chief government geologist of California. But the other scientists just wouldn't accept it. One of them, Dr. William Holmes from the Smithsonian Institution, said, if Dr. Whitney had understood the scientific theory of human evolution, he wouldn't have announced those discoveries because they couldn't possibly be true, because the human bones and the human artifacts were found in layers of rock 50 million years old, which is really too old for most scientists to accept today. They think humans like us came into existence only 100,000 years ago. So to have humans existing 50 million years ago in California was just impossible for them. But I learned that some of the artifacts from the California gold mines were still in the collection of the Museum of Anthropology at the University of California at Berkeley. So when Bill Cote was making this program, The Mysterious Origins of Man, I told him he should go to that museum. But when he went there, the museum officials denied him permission to see those artifacts. They're in the museum collections, but they're not shown to the public.
Wow.
That Indiana Jones doesn't, it really does happen.
Well, and what do you want to say to the scientists today who would ban you from the airwaves?
That's one group of them. There are some that, yes, they want to ban me from the airwaves, ban me from the science conferences, ban me from the universities. But there are some more open-minded ones.
Good.
I got a letter once from a student of archaeology at a university in the United States. And he told me that once he was out on an excavation with his professor, and he just mentioned to his professor, maybe human beings have been present on Earth for far longer than we now think possible. And his professor told him very quietly, I have a book you should read. And his professor gave him a copy of my book, Forbidden Archaeology. So this professor was secretly reading the book. This scientist, professional archaeologist, was secretly reading a copy of my book. And when he heard one of his students express some open-mindedness to this idea that humans have been around for such a long time, he gave the student the book, and then the student wrote to me and said, I want to devote my career as an archaeologist to finding more of the kinds of things that you're talking about in this book. So it's not a completely hopeless situation. There are a lot of scientists out there who are very conservative, who don't want to hear anything that contradicts their theories, who don't want to hear me speak, don't want anybody else to hear me speak. But there are others who either openly or privately find what I have to say very interesting. So,
why do you suppose the powers that be, and we can even name names if you'd like, why are they suppressing this information? What's the motivation?
I think, Carrie, there's a few reasons for it. One is, I think it's just human nature in this sense. Say I love somebody, and then someone tells me something bad about the person I love. I don't want to believe it. I won't hear it. It would take a lot, to convince me. So today, many scientists are just very much in love with their current theories of human origins. And when they hear something that goes against it, they just don't want to hear it. They can't accept it. It just completely shakes their whole picture of reality, what they thought is true. So I think that's one reason. It's human nature. I think another reason is the effectiveness of the knowledge filtering process that goes on in science that eliminates the kind of evidence that I'm talking about, from the textbooks, from the education system. That process is so effective that you find this kind of evidence is not mentioned in any of the textbooks, it's not taught in any of the schools, and therefore, if a student just innocently goes in to a university to study archaeology or something, and never hears from his professors or reads in his textbooks anything about this evidence, then when it comes to his attention from some other source, he thinks something must be wrong with it. There has to be something wrong with it. Otherwise, it would be mentioned in the textbooks, and my teachers would have told me about it, which is not necessarily true, you know. And then I think another factor is it has to do with power. And, you know, there are various kinds of power in this world. There's military power, there's political power, there's economic power, there's also intellectual power, which is a very real power, a very subtle one. And we see that those who have power really don't like to give it up. You know, for example, if one political party has a monopoly in the political life of the country, it doesn't want to give up its position. Or if one company has a monopoly in a certain sector of the economy, it doesn't want to give up its position. So if a group of scientists has a monopoly in the education system, which today the materialistic scientists, they do have a monopoly in the education system enforced by the government, they don't want to give up their position, which I think is very natural, because I think they understand that any alternative to their current theories is going to involve something spiritual. Something that has to do with consciousness and mind and things like that, which they really don't want to talk about, because I think they want to keep people focused on matter. Mm. Because if we're focused on matter, then we put all our human energy into producing and consuming more and more material things, and that generates huge amounts of money that flow into the pockets of the scientists who invent weapons, consumer products, all kinds of pharmaceuticals. It goes into the pockets of the corporations that sell the weapons, sell the pharmaceuticals, sell the consumer products. It goes into the pockets of the governments that tax all this economic activity. And we ourselves are, I mean, we have to admit, we ourselves are also a little bit guilty because we go along with it.
Well, it's hard not to if you're so controlled by the media.
Yes.
I mean, our whole education system is built on corporate education,
yes,
you know,
absolutely.
To keep us in that, like you say, the consumer, you know, and productive worker bee.
Yeah, because if we weren't doing that, if we were putting more time into yoga and meditation and contemplation and developing what I call the resource of consciousness, that would be less time that we'd be spending consuming and producing, which would cause huge shockwaves economically, politically. So they like to keep us, as you say, as the little worker bees.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. However, again, you know, I think we're just becoming so enlightened these days and waking up, you know, from that trance we've been in. And
yeah, certainly your radio show is part of that.
Thank you, and I want to thank BBS Radio for giving us this opportunity. It's wonderful, the information now that's out there. And, you know, we just keep doing our stuff here.
Well, I think that's what we're all doing. I think I don't think there's anything particularly unique about what I'm saying. I see myself as part of just a whole group of people who are coming to kind of a different understanding about what the purpose of human life is, and I think we're all just doing our part.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and yeah, we're building up a community, that's for sure. And there's strength in numbers, and you know, the more that we find ourselves coming out of the closet, so to speak, the more we'll feel supported for doing that. So. That's the good news. And you obviously have done that. And, wow, you've really opened up so much new information for people. You talk about the ancient Sanskrit writings. And, again, back to that information in the Vedas and so forth. They describe the Vimanas, the aircraft. Would you go into that in some detail?
Yes. We tend to think today that, you know, our current civilization is the first one that's developed like these really high technologies, like going into outer space and things like that. But if we look at the writings of the ancient wisdom traditions, and I'm very familiar with the ancient Sanskrit writings of India, we find similar kind of evidence there. The Vedas and the Puranas and the other Sanskrit writings tell of vimanas, or spacecraft, that could move from planet to planet, and not just from planet to planet, but from level to level of the cosmos. Because I think we don't live in a cosmos where it's just like space, and if you just go out in a spaceship, you just go through more and more space. I think there are different levels of reality that can only be penetrated if you're in a certain level of consciousness. So I think we're part of a whole cosmic hierarchy of beings where you have different levels of the cosmos inhabited by different beings existing on different levels. We have our level where things function on the level of gross matter. So I think there are vimanas or spacecraft that are made of ordinary metals. They're put together, you know, technologically, and they can go from planet to planet on our level of reality. But there are also vimanas that can travel not just, say, horizontally on our level, but vertically going to other levels of the cosmos. That the ancient Sanskrit writings say there are vimanas that can go from our level to the level of the subtle material energies, the subtle mind and intellectual energies that are inhabited by these astral beings, gods, goddesses, angels, things of that sort. And then there are vimanas that can penetrate even beyond that level and go to the level of pure consciousness, or spirit, if you like that word.
Would this be like the Merkaba, the light body that's spoken of in the Bible?
According to the ancient Sanskrit writings, there are different ways to travel. There are some yogis that can travel through all these different levels simply by manipulating their own subtle bodies.
Mm-hmm.
And that might be something similar to what you're talking about, the Merkaba.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are those that make use of vehicles, the vimanas, which can be of different types. There are vimanas made of ordinary matter, there are vimanas made of subtle matter, and there are vimanas that are made of spiritual elements. And they can travel through these different levels of reality. And my point would be that in one sense we're all extraterrestrials, in the sense that as beings of pure consciousness, we all come from a different level of reality. And we're meant to return there. And it's not necessary, you know, that has to happen after death. You could kind of be in this world, but not of it. You know, it's a position that you can achieve even in this life, where you can become aware of your original identity as a being of pure consciousness and relate to others on that level. It doesn't have to wait till after you die, but if we look at the laws of reincarnation, how we live this life is going to determine what our next position is. If we want to return to that original position of pure consciousness, then, you know, we should live our life that way. And we can either make the journey in our soul body or in a vehicle, like a vimana.
Mm-hmm. Do you work with the Kundalini at all?
Yeah, of course, there's so many different yoga systems from India. There's the one that I practice specifically is called Bhakti Yoga, the yoga of devotion, or the yoga of love. And there, what you try to do is, I mean, every morning I do a little physical yoga, but the main kind of yoga is to use your whole life, what you do, my writing, my speaking, everything, as dedicated in a loving spirit to trying to help others and to please the source of all conscious beings. That's So what I'm doing now actually is a kind of yoga. You know, this is my yoga, you know, speaking, writing, traveling, researching, doing all these things for this higher purpose.
What do you see happening in 2012, or do you see any change at all?
Well, according to the time calculations that are there as part of the it's a little bit different than what you mentioned in terms of the yugas, but according to what I can see from the teachings that I personally accept, we're in the Kali Yuga, which is normally like a dark age, but but just like, say, when winter is coming in a temperate climate, when winter is coming, sometimes you get some warm days. You know, even though it's becoming colder, you get a couple weeks.
Mm-hmm.
It's called like an Indian summer or something, where it becomes very pleasant. So I think that's what we're in now. Although we're in the Kali Yuga, which is an age of materialism, quarrel, and conflict, according to some of these ancient Sanskrit writings, there's kind of an Indian summer where things become spiritual around this time. Of course, that year 2012 fits within this time where things, although the trend is down, things start going up for a while. It'll continue like that for about 10,000 years, and then the Kali Yuga will finish, and then the next Satya Yuga will begin. I think it's a slightly different.
Well, they're a great cycle.
I think we
cycle.
Basically have the same idea, but the timings are a little bit different.
Well, I was talking about the 26,000 year cycle, but you're talking about the greater cycle.
The greater cycle,
yeah. Well, we all have to have our little cycles too, you know.
Yeah, cycles within cycles within cycles.
I think we kind of phase in and out, actually, and again, it's according to our consciousness. It's all about consciousness.
You can make, even though it's the middle of the Kali Yuga, you can make it the Satya Yuga, the golden age.
Absolutely. Yeah. So you see then that the devolution is that going to even speed up, or what's going to happen
level? I use the word devolution in three senses. One, the main sense I use it in is that we have devolved from our original position of pure consciousness and come down to this level of gross material reality. That's the main sense in which I use the word. I would say our purpose is to re-evolve, get back to that original position. The second sense in which I use the word devolution is in terms of this progression of yugas, progression of ages, and now we're in a downturn, but it'll go up again.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third sense in which I use the word devolution, but to get back to your point, I would say that how our society progresses and how our lives progress depend on each one of us. Now, for example, even if it's raining, you don't have to get wet. You can put up an umbrella, you can put up a tent, you can try to shelter yourself,
mm-hmm.
shelter your loved ones, shelter other people. So I think the direction that our human society takes in terms of this devolution process that goes on in the course of the passing of the ages, I think that depends largely on us, the kinds of decisions that each of us make. Because as you said, it does depend on us. Even though it's the Kali Yuga, we can make it the golden age for ourselves, for others, if we behave in the right way, if we make the right choices. And then the third sense in which I use the word devolution is our progress in the cycle of reincarnation. Because the human body is like a vehicle that can allow us to make progress, to return to our original position, to make the best we can. If we don't use it for the right purpose, then we could go down in the cycle of reincarnation,
mm-hmm.
which means taking birth again in lower species of life.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say all this depends on the choices that each of us makes as an individual, yes.
So is your goal to get off the wheel, I guess?
Well, it's off the wheel, but as I mentioned, you can even be on the wheel but not affected by it.
Mm.
You can be in but not of.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we can work to try to make even this world something like the spiritual world.
Mm-hmm.
Although we can't stay here forever, we can try to make it as nice as we can.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's possible. But eventually, yes, I think we do want to get out of the wheel, which is called the cycle of birth and death in Buddhism and Hinduism. It's
mm-hmm.
It's something that I think it's okay to aspire for, although according to many of these wisdom traditions, an even higher aspiration is even to remain on the wheel to help others.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's also possible.
Well, and that's a wonderful note to end on, more or less, because I want you to now announce any appearances you're going to be making, or your website that you'd like to let people know about. What else do you want to share with us?
Okay, well, as far as websites go, there's my personal website, mcremo.com, mcremo. If people want to leave messages for me, they can do that there. There's a mailbox there that they can leave messages for me. I do read my mail. I do reply to it. And then also on the website, they can find a list of upcoming interviews and speaking engagements. What I have coming up now, I have a lot of different audiences that I deal with, so upcoming I have some talks at the next meeting of the World Archaeological Congress, which is the world's largest international organization of archaeologists. It's having its meeting in Dublin, Ireland. It meets in different countries every year. So I'll be at the end of June, in the first week of July, I'll be in Dublin, Ireland, speaking at the World Archaeological Congress. And in the fall, I'll be doing a lecture tour of Russia.
Hmm.
And in the end of November, I'll be at a conference in Dubai where some of the leading figures in alternative history will be giving lectures.
Find out about the Stargate over there.
Yeah, and it's... so, yeah, the upcoming events will be listed on my website, mcremo.com, mcremo.
You know, you've obviously been received around the world in a wonderful way. That's speaking well of humanity. I'm so glad to
well,
hear
yes,
that.
It is really amazing. I mean, it is amazing. I mean, my books are now in 20 languages, and I only go where I'm invited. It seems that people all over the world are interested in alternative histories and the kinds of things that you speak about on this show, the paranormal, the spiritual practices for...
They're hungry for it.
...consciousness, yes. Mm-hmm. I find that all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
You can find people engaged in all kinds of yoga systems and things like that all over the world. So
and of course,
something nice.
You've made it happen because you really do come from the heart, Michael, and I really do appreciate that. And no wonder you're well received.
Well, and then I guess all of us whose hearts are awakening that way can link up through your radio show. Heartlink, right?
That's right. You've been listening to Carrie L's Heartlink show and our guest, Michael Cremo. And I'm so glad we've been able to have this opportunity to connect and broaden our horizons towards more freedom, light, and love. And thank you, Michael. Wonderful.
Thank you, Carrie L.
Well, thank you. And people, next time we'll have Dr. Bruce Lipton, and I'm looking forward to that special broadcast next week. So check out my website, heartlinkinstitute.com, and we'll see you next time. And thank you for listening. Bye-bye.